I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello one and all, and a warm welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and whether you're a brand new listener or one of our old friends, it's great to have you with us. And here we are then, Series 9, Episode 2. And we're feeling pretty darn excited because today we're joined by two fabulous debut authors who are limbering up to go head to head in a war of the words. My first guest is a former book editor who then worked for 10 years as the head of drama series at HBO. She divides her time between Los Angeles, Cape Cod, and London, which has made me insanely jealous already, and is here to tell us about her debut novel, The Paper Palace. Miranda Cowley Heller, welcome to Book Off. Lovely to see you.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled and totally unprepared.
And my second guest grew up in a crematorium in Birmingham, similar to Cape Cod in many ways, and is now a creative writing supervisor at Lucy Cavendish College, Cambridge. Her debut novel, A Terrible Kindness, was recently a Radio 2 Book Club choice. That's a mark of quality. And was shortlisted for the Bridport Peggy Chapman Andrews Award. Here to tell us more about that very book and her writing journey, it's Jo Browning Rowe. Hello to you.
Hello. Thanks very much for having me.
What a pleasure to have you both here. And Miranda, do we find you in Los Angeles or London or Cape Cod or some other exotic location?
You find me in the very unexotic Los Angeles at 9 in the morning. And
I love the time difference thing here because for me and Joe, it's Friday night and it's Friday morning for you, Miranda. Yeah. And of course, I've taken this opportunity to crack open a beer. That's how relaxed I'm feeling about this whole thing. But Joe is very professional and just sticking to water.
You are? Well, okay. I need about 10 more cups of espresso. But having said that.
And how are you feeling, Joe, after the last week or so that's just been filled with so many things and glorious things, you know, with this book?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's been a whirlwind. And a friend of mine who is in the media said to me, hold tight, Joe. And I did say to him, well, if you could be really specific about actually how I do that, that'd be really helpful. Because, these things happen and you know you're supposed to process them and you just don't know how. So you just sort of bumble along and try and enjoy it. But no, it's been crazy. Lots of interviews and lots of technical nightmares, but I'm doing all right.
Good. We're glad to hear it. And it's lovely to have you both here. And you sort of know each other a bit, do you? Because you certainly are both fans of each other's books, and I think you've been in touch, in authorly touch. But this is maybe the first time you've done something together?
Absolutely. And yes, we've been in a very oblique authorly touch.
That's right.
However, I read Joe's extraordinary novel and loved it so much. So
thank you. Well, and yeah. same here. And actually, if I wasn't going head to head against Miranda, I probably would have pitched her book. And actually, as I'm saying it, I should maybe do that because then she might go easy on me because she'd want me to win. So just sudden change.
The only thing about doing that, though, Joe, is that either way she wins. So, you know.
Oh, that's true. We can't have that. That's true. That's not Yeah.
It's you're going to be fine. You're going to win. Don't worry. And I'm very competitive, but this time I'm giving it up to you because you deserve it, definitely.
And of course, my guests are talking about the book off, which we will be doing a bit later on. This is where each of them gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book they love and think that we should all read. But before we get there, it's time to talk about both of your books. And Joe, I'll start with you. And A Terrible Kindness, which is a coming-of-age tale. It tells the story of a young embalmer called William. And there'll be some listeners who have read it and love it and want to hear you talk about it. And there'll be some listeners who are joining us thinking, oh, yes, I've seen that book and someone mentioned it. And for those that haven't got to it yet, perhaps you could start by telling us what it's about.
Yeah. Well, it's about a young embalmer, William Lavery, who has just qualified. He's the youngest in the country, and he's just passed his exams with unprecedented results in both practical and written work. So the story opens in October 1966, the day after his graduation, and he's at the annual Embalmer's Dinner Dance in Nottingham, where his success is going to be celebrated. But a telegram arrives from Aberfan, where a coal waste tip has ploughed down a mountainside, killing 116 children. So William and other embalmers from throughout the country drive through the night to help prepare the bodies for the parents to identify. So the story follows him over the next few hours, these deeply significant hours in his life at Aberfan. But then it reels back to show William's life leading up to this point, showing how he went to Aberfan with his own loss and trauma, and how we see how the death of his father when he was only 8 sort of cracked apart the affectionate but sort of dysfunctional family. And then we see as a scholarship boy chorister in Cambridge, he has a really happy time. He has an exceptional voice that makes a deep friendship with a boy called Martin, a big character with a big loyalty to William. But the time there as a boy chorister comes to an abrupt and quite dramatic end, again, really as the result of these cracks in his family relationships. So then he decides to follow his uncle in the embalming family business against his mother's wishes, who wants him to pursue a musical career. And so then we see him training as an embalmer in Stepney, where he falls in love with Gloria Finch. And that takes us up to the point where he goes to Aberfan. And then after Aberfan, he's got PTSD, his marriage is suffering, and he's something needs to give because he's reaching rock bottom. So he goes back to Cambridge. He reconnects with his old friend Martin and with his musical roots, helping his friend Martin with the choir for the homeless. And that sort of that opens something in him. It moves something in him, and he's able to start to deal with the things he needs to deal with. And that ultimately takes him back to Aberfan, where he can make peace with himself and those around him.
And am I right in thinking that actually the germ of the idea for this book came when you were researching something completely different, then you read a story in the library, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It was some conference papers of the gathered embalmers and undertakers in Great Britain, and I was reading about something else, and then I just saw this article by the embalmers of Great Britain, and I just thought, well, what would that be? And read it and just was absolutely spellbound by this heroic kindness that they demonstrated.
Hmm. I mean, it's a fabulous book, and I want to talk more about it, and also about your trip over to Belfast, I think it was, to do some interviews. Miranda, if I could talk to you about the Paper Palace, though, for a moment. We've mentioned Cape Cod already. Now, this is a place that you've spent many summers as a child, I believe. What was it that made you want to set your novel there? Was it just always going to be about that place, you know, as the first book that you've written?
I think so, yes, in a way. I wanted, it's a place that sort of grounded my life and had a profound impact on me. And when I started writing The Paper Palace, which was a very long time ago, actually, and then put it away in a drawer, I started at the time 3 books, and they all were completely different genres, and they all started in the same place. So I think the answer to that is probably yes. So yeah, and it's and though a lot of the novel is set there, it's also set, of course, in other places, but the 24-hour day is set in a place very akin to where I was raised. And so the stage set is very accurate. The story is not. thank God for me. But but the stage sets are, some of them are real, and certainly that one.
And as you said, it's told over a 24-hour period, but also a 50-year period. So can you just set up the story for those that won't have read this yet and maybe introduce us to Elle?
Absolutely. So the Paper Palace is, as you just said, it's set in two different time periods. It 50 years in one woman's life and 24 hours in her life. And in a sense, both represent an entire life in their different ways. Mm-hmm. It's a story of one woman's life, Elle Bishop, who is around 50 years old, married, very happily married with three children. And she's at her mother's old summer camp, which is a rundown, not a fancy camp that, you know, a lot of people imagine when they think of Cape Cod, they think of kind of a part of the Cape with the yachts and the Kennedys and well-trimmed lawns and you know, whale belts and so on. The outer Cape, where I grew up and where this takes place, is a completely different landscape. It's a beautiful but very rough landscape. High dunes that some of which you can't, many of which you can't possibly get down. They're too high. That go out to this rough Atlantic. It's you know, dirt roads and paths and artists and it's this place where you can get lost. And it's a deeply, I would say, passionate landscape, unlike what most people associate with Cape Cod. In any event, so Elle is at her family's rundown summer camp, and she wakes up, the beginning of the book, she wakes up hour one, as it were, and goes for a swim in the pond. The house is set on a pond, a freshwater pond that is walking distance to the ocean, and she takes this swim during which she remembers what she did the night before. Something rather awful, which is her mother's having a dinner party, and the guests are all there. And for some reason, for the first time in their 40-year friendship, she and her best friend, Jonas, go out the back door during the dinner party and have unbelievably hot sex. And she's never done anything like this before. Her marriage is great, as I said. And so that when the book opens, she realizes she's at a crossroads. Jonas is the man she always thought she would marry, who she's loved all her life, but because of something terrible they did in their childhood, they could never, ever be together. Her husband, Peter, is British, and he is a really interesting. He's a writer, a journalist, very different type. Jonas is a painter. He's, you know, he's Daniel Day-Lewis in Last of the Mohicans, let's put it that way. He's, you know, a creature of nature and passion and, you know, and Peter looks really good in a suit, right? Anyway, so over the next 24 hours, Elle has to just choose the life she wants. And there's no bad choice, because first, what you get to know over the 50 years is why. And so there's a mystery that kind of runs through its core, which is not a sort of a whodunit, but a whydunit. And the 50 years is told in pieces, seminal moments for her that lead her and end actually the day before, as she's stepping outside to have sex with Jonas. And then it's the day and the decision.
And it's just such a fab read. And, you know, it really took me there as well, Miranda. I mean, I haven't been actually to Cape Cod, but I sort of feel like I have a bit now. And I think
I highly recommend it.
Yeah,
it is a very, very beautiful place, and thus far unspoiled, because it's part of a national park. So yeah, it's where we are. And so there's miles of coastline with no homes on them. And, yeah, you know, you can get, as I say, if you live there, you're in the know. But it's not a fancy place at all. The people are old intellectuals and sort of preppy bohemians, maybe.
Mm. Have people tried to come and find it, Miranda, since the book's been out? Have you had pilgrims?
No. I mean, you can't find it unless you know where to look. And it's not a literal description of where it is. So But they better not, because that was the first question, you know, my family asked. If yeah. this happens, we will never forget
you. Exactly. Yeah.
And I should just say very quickly that the novel is, of course, about this. It's about her. It's not about the two men. I mean, the two men are sort of representative, but I think it's about growing up with divorce. It has to do with sexual abuse and being a survivor. It's about the choices one makes that lead you to make, you know, that lead your life completely in one direction or another, and facing an life choice where you want to determine who I'm going to be in the future at age 50, which I think sort of COVID has raised for a lot of us, in fact, although it wasn't written for, during, or, you know, COVID, but that we all think that, you know, more about mortality, maybe in a slightly more present way.
I agree. I think that's absolutely true. And as you say, you wrote this quite a long time ago. I certainly started writing a long time, so it wasn't anything to do with COVID. It probably wasn't even on the agenda, was it?
God,
actually were.
No. No. 5 years, 6 years ago at this point, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And how long has it taken for A Terrible Kindness to arrive, Jo?
Well, from first idea to now, a long time. I think I started interviewing in 2016, maybe. But I have to say, after I'd done the interviews and I put it aside and I was working on other things. So actually, I think I wrote it quite quickly once I'd done the research and I was ready to go. I think sort of maybe 3 years if you discount the research part.
When we spoke about this before, you said, "Oh, you know, it's daunting. It's sort of a daunting responsibility to write about Abhavan." And in fact, you told me a story, which I'd love you to tell the listeners, about going to speak to some embalmers and that, you know, that experience with them. And I think that probably sealed it in your mind as being okay.
Yes, or a possibility. Yes. So I'd read the account of the embalmers at Abhavan. And so then I got in touch with the Institute of Embalmers and I said, "Are any of these men still alive? And could I talk to any of them?" And so the woman I spoke to said, there are some still alive, but I would want to talk to them first because understandably this is a sensitive area. So, but then she got back fairly quickly and she said, "This one guy is happy to talk to you," and he was in Belfast. So I flew out to see him. I mean, it's interesting because I wasn't a published novelist at this point. I had no, you know, no guarantees, but I was just driven. I just had to go and talk to him. And so we chatted in the cafe of the airport. And he was charming, as so many Irish people are, just lovely chat. And then we settled and he just said, "You need to leave Abhavan well alone." And so I just then started asking back questions. Anyway, it turned out he hadn't spoken to anybody about this in 40 years, nobody. And he started talking and 4.5 hours later, he stopped talking. And then he said, "Maybe this is a story that you could tell." And so, you know, I would never say that was permission, but it made me think, okay, this is something I could possibly try and do.
And it's brilliant. So,
thank you.
Yeah. It is. Well, it is, Jo. And, you know, you should, because it could have, as I said, the responsibility of doing something like this must have been something that you really weighed up, and you have approached it so sensitively and in the right way. Because also, I think it's important to say it's a book about family, isn't it? It's a book about the power of love. It's not a book about the disaster.
No, it's not. And that's right. And it was about one person who went, and an imaginative telling of a person who went, using really heavily, you know, leaning really heavily on the accounts that I was given. And I would never, I personally would never have attempted to write a novel about a person who lived in Abhavan, or, you know, I just wouldn't have gone there. But this felt somebody from the outside going in, coming out again. I felt that was okay to have a go at. Always, as I've said before, with every sentence, trying to do it as respectfully as I could. And some people have said, "Why didn't you make up a disaster?" And it just wouldn't have felt grounded. It would be almost, you know, I mean, nobody said to Sebastian Foulkes, "Why didn't you make up a war?" You know, there's a lot of people really hurt in the First World War. I mean, I know there are some differences, but it just felt it was about this disaster. You know, this was the disaster to which these people went. So
I think also, Jo, that if you had made one up, what happens in that situation is readers and reviewers and everyone sort of draws a comparison anyway. They go, "Well, it sounds like Abhavan, for example."
Yeah, you know, exactly.
And you think, well,
exactly.
Yeah, Okay, so
yeah,
it's yeah. I agree with you. It's to write about and around the real event is probably more powerful.
Yes,
I would,
yeah.
I would say.
And I was very hugely relieved when the Welsh Press said that this book does not appropriate or invade the experience of Aberfan. And I could almost breathe again once I'd read that. So
yes,
that was great. Yeah.
Miranda, I'm fascinated to know more about your role at HBO, because that sounds like it was a fantastic job for 10 years. And I imagine it probably influenced your writing, because I've, as I said, found the descriptions in this book incredibly visual.
Thank you. First of all, I guess I should just say that my time at HBO was a very long time ago now, because I was there sort of during the heyday. I started when the department was begun. I had no experience in that area whatsoever. So my first show there was The Sopranos. That was our first drama series.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Yeah. It was okay. Yeah, it was okay. And The Wire, which is actually probably my personal favorite, and so on. I think to that point, reading thousands of scripts where dialogue is so obviously prominent, but you have to bring your imagination to the visual. And then when you see it, the way that it is sort of cut together, the way you can suspend a moment. So I think at the dialogue piece definitely came out of that. But I think also for me, I've been accused of maybe ironically spareness, because I wouldn't say that the dialogues are spare, but that the sort of, for me, the cardinal rule that I would take away from HBO, I think, is that of all script writing, which is show me, don't tell me, and in dialogue, right?
Mm.
And so that for me was really helpful. And I've always thought visually. I grew up in a family of painters and painters and their muses, because a different time of life, but
sounds fabulous.
So yes, I've always, my family is, my mother's most important thing for her was how to set a table, so that, by the way, that was probably more influential for me in many ways to the theme of the book anyway than the HBO experience, which was wonderful to be there in its golden age, so to speak.
Yeah.
My mother's idea was that a beautiful table has to be set so that after the meal, the remains are what is left is as beautiful as what came before. And so my stepfather would actually paint, the table.
Wow.
Sometimes. Yeah. After, she wanted, so in a way that's a huge piece of what sort of a running theme. In the Paper Palace.
I need to up my table game.
Yeah, absolutely. And the novel starts with the remains of a dinner party the night before, and sort of ends to a certain extent with them setting the table before dinner. Mm. That comes toward the end of the novel, and the table itself is what sets off all of her feelings in a way. Remembering this man she's passionately in love with. This morning, definitely, by picking up the glass he drank his wine from and putting it to her lips. It's not just, it's kind of, well, now what comes after, the act,
yeah,
so to speak.
I'm always fascinated in literature, especially, and in life, with father-son relationships. And I wondered if you were fascinated with mother-daughter relationships, because obviously there's an important relationship in this novel between Elle and her mother Wallace.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And in a way, the arc of their relationship is more sort of important to me, and her
right.
with her sister as well. I think I'm so interested in the things, not just the choices we make, but the choices we inherit And even our, the way our parents' love lives can actually, you know, change our lives or determine the direction of our lives, not just kind of, and in this, there are generations of women. So there's not just Elle and her mother, Wallace, there's Wallace's mother and whoever comes before that. But the decision that and these are all really powerful women who have all gone through terrible things and found different ways in each of them to survive that or to make a choice about that. And each of those choices is what leads Elle to make her choice. So I think for one thing, that's something that just really interests me. You know, if, for those of you who've read it, you know, if Wallace's mother hadn't taken her husband's side, as it were, Wallace wouldn't have become the person she is, who's both hilarious but also emotionally guarded. If she hadn't become that person when Elle goes through her trauma, would she have been able to come to her mom? Would they have had, you know, you can't answer questions, but you can certainly ask them, right? And what will happen now to Elle's daughter? And so that sort of trickle down emotional economics has always really interested me, but also just the relationship of mother and daughter, you know, and their sparring, but their love. And it's really her mother in the end who sort of gives her permission to make whichever choice she wants, you know. A conversation in the end, it really is the permission of a mother that she feels she has hurt and lied to, gives, you know, sort of forgiving her in a way, redeeming.
As well as these two fabulous books, I always ask my guests what else they've been reading so that we can give our listeners a few more books to put on the to-be-read pile. Joe, have you found any time? I know you've been busy the last few weeks. You found any time to sort of read over the last couple of months? And is there anything you want to recommend?
Yes. I never stop reading, really. So it's always at night in the bath, at hot bath, and read for an hour. But yeah, two.
That an hour? Oh, that's good. Wow.
Yes, well I done. Know. You can get through quite a lot in an hour. So the first one is been out for a while. It's The Seal Woman's Gift by Sally Magnusson. And I'm surprised that this book isn't talked about more. So the starting point is this notorious, apparently, I of course have never heard of it, historical event in 1627 where pirates raided the coast of Iceland and abducted 400 people into slavery in the Algiers. And among those people was a pastor and his wife and their children. And so the book, imaginative then, follows the wife, Asta, as she finds herself separated from her husband and all but one of her children and living in a beautiful, sun-filled Muslim palace. And the contrast from her rural, weather-beaten, cold way of life in Iceland to being in this sunny, opulent Islamic country, it's a phenomenal imaginative exploration with all the challenges to her heart, mind and her faith. So that's that one. And then the other one, it's not quite out yet. This is the joy of being an author. You get proof copies. I just love it. So this book is almost out. It's out beginning of February. And it's The Colony by Audrey McGee. She was a shortlist of the Women's Prize for Fiction with her book, The Undertaking. But this is about two men arriving on a remote Irish island. One's an artist. He wants to make paintings. He's come from London and he wants to make paintings for an exhibition to go back to London and hopefully resurrect his waning reputation. And the other is a Frenchman passionate about languages threatened with extinction. And he comes every year to study the language on the island and track how it might be eroding. So we have two men, outsiders, both there for their own professional and personal reasons. And then there's the people on the island and how they feel about these outsiders and what they're doing and saying. So it's fantastic evocation of landscape, art, language. It's just amazing. And about so much more, but I can't go into it now. So that's The Colony by Audrey McGee.
Fantastic. Thank you, Joe. And what about you, Miranda? What have you been reading and enjoying recently?
Well, I'm trying to get caught up. I think a lot of writers don't read a lot, or many do, but I don't read a lot when I'm writing. And since I was writing for far too long, I feel like I got really far behind. So some of the books that I've read recently are books that everybody else read, you know, a while back. Although my A Sorrow and Bliss is a novel by Meg Mason that I think is fantastic. And I read very recently, it deals with marriage and mental health issues, but it's painful, but it's hilarious in places. I think she manages to this balance between, I mean, some of the, I laughed out loud in a book that's about a sort of tragic personal events. And then of course the end, you know, well, I'm not going to give away the ending, but it's the characters are brilliant. And the sister relationship is just so funny, but poignant. And I thought there's I like sort of to a certain extent, sort of spare writing, not writing in which it's all character speaking and not sort of what's that character's, you know, what do they call it? Like not internet, there's a word. But anyway, so I love Sorrow and Bliss. I think that's fantastic. I actually have been listening to, I should say, and I really recommend everybody go back and read Sense and Sensibility. I've been listening to the Rosamund Pike version, and it is so modern a novel. Pride and Prejudice was always one of my desert island books, as it were. But Sense and Sensibility is the funniest book. There are two or three pages of dialogue at one point in which both characters are lying to each other in the without, you know, they're just being lovely, but they're lying to each other the entire conversation, and you know it, but she's so wry. And then there's a character who comes in and somebody says, oh, isn't this a lovely cottage? And she says, you know, and the character goes, no, it's disgusting. I mean, that's the word she uses. He's a moron, he says, in front of the person. You know, it's a no-holds-bar, you know, look at sort of social, you know, social life. But it's so ironic and really funny. And so, and this is my new discovery, is if you listen to certain books that were always my favorites, and I mean, I was listening to Middlemarch on a long drive, and I was giggling. I mean, how many people giggle their way through Middlemarch, right? Just to say that.
Yeah.
I just also read A Gentleman in Moscow, which so many people, you know by Amor Tulse, but I thought that was a wonderful novel. It's about a man who, you know, and a little girl who is confined to one building, but finds within it, you know, multitudes of life, and not a claustrophobia ever, but a way of, you know, it's a sort of incredible metaphor, I think, for looking inward instead of looking outward for the meaning of life. So I really loved that. And I read a lot of poetry as well. So I've been, kind of dipping into Eileen Miles and you know, various people. But those are a couple of books that I've read. A lot of other books, I will say, to get caught up, that I liked. But I didn't maybe love.
That's a great list. And actually, the Amor Tulse book, Gentleman in Moscow, is an interesting one to have come to around lockdown. Because I think, you know, I read it years and years ago, but thinking about it now, actually in a sort of COVID situation, and when we've all been a lot more indoors and had to stay in, it might have a slightly different feel to it, maybe. And Lincoln Highway is his new one, and I can recommend that one as well if you're looking for another.
It's on my list, of course. It's on my guilt pile next to my bed.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLL and branch.com today Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, it's time now for the book off, and this is where each of my guests gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book that they love and they think we should all read. And Joe and Miranda, you don't have to use all of your 3 minutes, but if you're still speaking at the 3 minute mark, you will either be honked out by the bicycle horn or rung out by the school bell. So we've got a little bit of admin to do before we get into this. As you have travelled the furthest, Miranda, to be here, would you like to go first or would you like to go second?
Well, I think I'm going to go second, not out of cowardice, but just so I have three extra minutes to prepare.
No problem at all. And Joe, at the 3 minute mark, yes. As I said, I'll be honking or ringing you out. Which one would you like?
I want to be honked because in Cambridge, I've always wanted on my bike to have one of those, but I always feel it'd be just too frightening for people. I give someone a heart attack, but I love the sound. Yeah.
The honk it is for you then. Fantastic. Yeah, okay. Right then, I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock for you, Joe, going first. Okay. This is uninterrupted to tell us about the book of your choice. Before we start the timer, just tell us the book you're putting forward, please.
It is A Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin.
Fantastic. Okay. All right. It's over to you then. 3 minutes on the clock to tell us about A Manual for Cleaning Women. Over to you.
Well, I was sent this book out of the blue by a friend. I'd never heard of Lucia Berlin, but he has great taste, so I dived right in and fell in love. It was published in 2015 and the book went to the New York Times bestseller list in its second week, and then she rose to sudden literary fame. Sadly, this was 11 years after her death, and this book outsold all her previous books combined. So I will tell you a bit about her life, because the stories in the book have been described as autofiction or self-fiction. So, born in 1936 in Alaska, she was plagued by ill health, including double scoliosis from the age of 10, which meant she spent periods of her life wearing a steel brace. In photographs, she's beautiful and has an undeniable air of glamour to her. Living in many different places, she worked as a switchboard operator, hospital ward clerk, emergency room nurse, high school teacher and cleaning woman, while writing, raising 4 sons and struggling with alcoholism, from which she was eventually in recovery. In the mid-90s, she went to the University of Colorado and spent 6 years as a visiting writer and ultimately associate professor, where she was a popular and beloved teacher. And she died on her 68th birthday in 2004. She's likened to Raymond Carver. Her gritty stories take place in the inner city, the slums, on night buses and late night laundromats. The characters are lonely children, pregnant teenagers, lost middle-aged women, often alcoholic. She's also likened to Grace Paley, but she's very much has her own style, combining this eagle-eyed detail, humour and the messiness of humanity, but always, I feel, written with compassion for that messiness by her. I teach creative writing and I often use stories in this collection to show you don't need a lot of words to tell a big story. You just need the right ones. McAdam, for instance, is 150 words long, and yet she manages to tell the story of three generations of women beautifully in just these few lines. So I want people to read this book because it's wonderful writing. Her characters are vivid, funny, infuriating, and also because it's testimony to her life, which was one of considerable struggle and heartache, but out of which she managed to produce these stories of raw and ragged beauty. But her writing is by no means ragged. It's beautifully, beautifully honed. She said, this is a quote, writers are people who need to affirm, need an affirmation about their life. And to me, it's a way to make things positive, not in a corny way, but to make beauty out of negative things or difficult times or just make sense. So, end quote. I think it's always sad when someone doesn't receive the recognition they deserve in their own lifetime. So I'm really keen to champion Lucia Berlin and this book, A Manual for Cleaning Women.
Whoa! Fantastic. 10 seconds to spare as well, Joe. You're such a pro. Such a pro. Fantastic. Wow, I loved that. Thank you so much for that pitch. And we will return and talk about it a little bit in a little bit. You can take a breather now. Have a sip of water.
Have a glass of water.
Because I'm putting 3 minutes back. Have a glass of water. Because I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock for you, Miranda. And before we start, could you just tell us the book that you're putting forward, please?
Yes, I can. Because I'm apparently, you know, really want to lose the contest. I'm going to try to pitch The Lord of the Rings in 3 minutes.
Well, if anyone can do it, you can do it, Miranda. It's 3 minutes on the clock then for you to tell us all about The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Okay. Well, I think the first question is why on earth I would choose to pitch this book. It's like Coles to Newcastle, one of the greatest novels ever written in Britain, and in fact written as a kind of new mythology taken from Beowulf, from the Arthurian, a lot, you know, the Arthurian Mort d'Arthur, and it's War and Peace, and it's Othello, and it's romantic, and it's this incredible adventure. And it's at its heart really about the fight for decency, about wars. You said earlier about Sebastian Fox, and in fact about Joe's book, that, you know, writing about and around a real experience you prefer, and I'm going to argue against that and say that this one is one of the great war novels ever written, partly because it can be applied to any of the great wars and dictators. And as, you know, Tolkien himself said that it wasn't an allegory, but for atomic power, he said that, but the power of, you know, exerted for domination over decency. And, you know, I think this book was inspired for him out of World War I and the Battle of the Somme, where several of his very best friends died. The wasteland that Frodo and Sam come to at the end is trench warfare, but it could be any of those things. And so, you know, clearly I feel like it's written for the British as, you know, a country that fought, many times in the last century, and I'm sure will again, for their values and for and sacrifice. I mean, more men died in World War I, more British men than in any other war, I think, more men in general. And, you know, I think it's inspired by those battles that the British have gone through, hundreds of battles over hundreds of years, fought and lost and won for an idea, sort of, for a myth, in a sense. And so if you've read the novel, I'm not pitching it to you. If you haven't, and if you haven't because maybe you think, you know, it's fantasy, so it's, you know, the genre of the nerd, I am going to disagree with you completely. It is romantic. It's a page-turner. It's a seminal novel, not just for the world, but particularly written for and about the British, inspired because he was of C.S. Lewis and his close relationship with C.S. Lewis. I couldn't put it down. It was the first novel my father ever gave me after my parents got divorced. I was 12. I was on a long bus trip, 8 hours alone. He handed it to me, and I looked up, and I was at my destination. You cannot miss this book. If you do, you've missed one of the great experiences of life.
Oh, fantastic. With also 10 seconds left to go, Miranda. It's like, this is, you know. And what a TV pitching line right at the end there. I love that. You must have worked for HBO. Well done.
I'm at a disadvantage.
Oh, no. It was a long time ago.
Two incredibly different books and two wonderful pictures. Now, I must say, Joe, I don't know of A Manual for Cleaning Women, and I don't know of Lucia, and hearing you talk about just made me think, right, why don't I? And I guess part of the reason for your pitch and indeed talking about this book is so that people like me and other listeners go, right, I'm going to check out Lucia Berlin. Because it sounds like a wonderful book. And her life sounds, I mean, obviously a tough one, but an amazing one at the same time.
That's right. And I should say, actually, I mean, I think you know, she was an extraordinary writer, an extraordinary person. There's also, for me, there's a huge draw to American literature, because when I was 21, I went to live in America, and I decided that I was just going to read American literature while I lived there. And there was a great second-hand bookstore around the just down the road. And I just read and read and read and read. And I just read through the sort of the, you know, obviously not the whole canon, but a lot of the modern American literature, and just loved it. And she just takes you into that, oh my gosh, does she take you into a sort of, well, in the same way that Miranda's book did. You know, I had some fabulous East Coast holidays at Nag's Head, which I know is different to Cape Cod, but still there's a certain similarity of those great big fantastic holiday intergenerational holiday homes. And so I love to be taken there. But I think she's important. I think she, you know, she really talks about important things in her work, and it was absolutely out of her own struggle. And I just think it's tragic that she didn't have that success. And although it's lovely that she was such a loved teacher, she was so good as a teacher. So that's great. Yeah.
I mean, that was a lovely part of the pitch. And then obviously, you know, you're talking about this book that I think you said 11 years after she actually died that it was published and got this recognition. And yes, that's sad, but also what a lovely thing, you know, to have left this mark on the world of literature. And then you're sort of, you likened, or she has been likened to that Raymond Carver, which I just was instantly, my ears pricked up, and I thought, well, I'm going to love it then, you know.
Yes.
And the fact that you use this phrase, eagle-eyed detail and humour, and I just thought, yes, I think I know what you mean. I think I know the sort of writing that is, you know, which I would love.
And you know, the way she, because she was, you know, for a long time she worked in an ER ward, and she also worked on the switchboard in the hospital, and so she has such hilarious stories about the doctor's voices and what all the switchboard operators used to surmise about the doctor's voices. It's very, very funny as well, and quirky.
So it sounds fab. It sounds absolutely fab.
It does.
And yes, now Miranda, Lord of the Rings is, I mean, literally, when you even said it, I think, one of the, you know, greatest novels ever. It just is. There'll be many people listening who go, yes, I know, because I've read it. And some that may think, oh, yeah, I've always meant to get round to it. And I think that was another big part of your pitch, is that, you know, it's that there are some people that won't have read it yet, and they might just be a bit put off by it being, oh, just that fantasy nonsense, right, you know, or I've seen the film. It holds a very special place in my heart for several reasons. One, because my dad absolutely loves this book, and he read it when he was a kid. And I think the same thing as you, was just engrossed, you know, couldn't put it down. And then introduced me to it via a radio play recording of it that the BBC did. And that's how I first sort of discovered the book, and then I read it latterly. So yeah, I mean, all those things that you said about it, I absolutely agree. It is a complete page turner. It isn't just fantasy. The war, I'd not really stopped to think as deeply about the war novel comparison. I mean, yes, obviously it makes sense thinking about when he was writing, but I hadn't actually thought that. So I just, that was really interesting to hear you talk about that, because as soon as you did, I thought, yeah, of course it is. And that one of those very last scenes in the wasteland, I was like, oh goodness, yeah, that's it, it's World War One. So you're right, for anyone who hasn't, do read this book, because it is marvellous. And I have never reread it, because I don't know have you've reread it, have you?
I've reread it probably ten times. Yeah,
wow.
Okay, well, so do you get just as much or more out of it every time? Because I think hesitant, because I loved it so much that I don't want to ruin that, if you know what I mean. You know, that feeling I have towards it.
How old were you when you first read it?
Good question. 4 or 15?
Right.
I thought you would say 4 or 5 then.
Well, he is a genius.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that, you know, I think you must reread it. But you know that thing where there's books that you read when you were in your teens, say, or even, well, yeah, that are so huge in your mind, but you go back to them now and you think, well, but hold on, all those descriptions, they're not actually in it. I wonder sometimes if that's because, you know, For example, some of these books I go back and read and they were my favorite books in the world. And I think that they are. And then I throw them across the room in an absolute rage at the end, right? One of them being The Great Gatsby, which, you know, of course the ending is incredible and the book's incredible, but I was like, it's so withheld in a way. And, you know, I remember every tree, every detail, every flower, every smell. And I think we bring so much imagination when we are younger in a certain way and visualize our own things. I had the same experience with one of my other favorite books, The King Must Die by Mary Renault, which I think everybody also should read. And when I went back, you know, I was talking about the sexy and the snakes and these incredible scenes and the minotaur and blah, blah. And I went back and I'm like, but it's like a line. But in my mind, I was able to completely fill that in with my imagination in my head. Whereas Lord of the Rings, it is all there. It's still all there every time.
Right,
and
right.
And I think it's, you know, I said earlier, Pride and Prejudice is one of my Desert Island Disc books. And the other one is The Lord of the Rings, which I think people are surprised by when they meet me and they go, really? You know, and I, it's like, really? You know, they think, you know, they're sort of, oh, we thought you were much more sophisticated than that. I'm like, it is sophisticated.
Oh, yeah.
It is difficult. It contains every genre, you know,
yeah.
And I think, and it's so important to me anyway, you know, and I think this is why the war piece I focused on today, because all of those, the Knights of the Round Table, whatever, whether it's Beowulf or War and Peace or, you know, they come out of the fight. I mean, the adventure of the epic, I think, is often, you know, the fight to keep the good alive, let's put it that way, and this, and sacrifice, you know, and on that way, there are incredible sacrifices and archetypal, you know, characters and so on and so forth, you know, but I think there's a line I'll just quickly read if you'll allow me, and we have time, because, you know, as I say, I think it's sort of about, you know, men fighting about, you know, or life that we have lived is still on the good side, huh? You know, is still about, you know, sometimes fighting against insurmountable odds and sometimes losing and sometimes winning, but that you nevertheless have to do it. And at the very end, Frodo, you know, the main character, or one of, he's talking to Sam and he says, I tried to save the Shire, right? And it has been saved, but not for me. It must often be so, Sam, when things are in danger, someone has to give them up, lose them so that others may keep them. And I think that is, that's what the Battle of the Somme was, and that's what Vietnam was, and that's what, you know, well, actually, Vietnam was a stupid war, in my opinion, but those who fought in it, you know, lost their lives for their beliefs, unless they were drafted against their will. But, you know, those who joined up and you know, there's the courage, decency, and then an entire language written in Elvish, you know,
yes.
Really?
Yeah, I know.
With poetry and like long epic poems, you know, that's insane. It's amazing and beautiful and imaginative. So,
yeah.
Okay, now I want to read a short extract. Is that okay, Joe? First five lines of one of my favourite stories of the collection, My Jockey. I like working in emergency. You meet men there anyway. Real men, heroes, firemen and jockeys. They're always coming into emergency rooms. Jockeys have wonderful x-rays. They break bones all the time, but just tape themselves up and ride the next race. Their skeletons look like trees, like reconstructed brontosaurs. Thank you. Just wanted her to get a bit of air.
Okay. I'm with you. Yeah, absolutely.
This is a new thing you've introduced to the book off here, the sort of to pick a line from the book. Maybe this is something that's going to continue throughout the series now. We'll just introduce that in. You know, everyone gets to pick a line from the book. I don't know if you have been to Oxford, Miranda. I know you've spent some time in London. You have you?
My son just got a graduate degree there, so I went to his graduation.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, did you by any chance go to a pub called the Eagle and Child?
I didn't because it was COVID and everything was closed.
Of course, you couldn't. Okay, well, when you come back over, hopefully in the not too distant future, give me and Joe a call because we're gonna head over to Oxford with you. And we're going to go to the Eagle and Charle. And the reason we're going to go there is because, Miranda, this is honestly one of my favourite experiences ever. It's where Tolkien wrote a lot of that book. And if you sit in a particular seat in the pub, it is the exact description of where Strider first appears in the inn.
Oh, my God. Is he in the corner but with his knees up and the hat over his head?
And if you take the book and read it and then look across, and I'll show you exactly where to be, it is, you see how he wrote it. And it is the
we're doing this.
Yeah.
Oh, also, that way great. I get to meet both of you, but Joe.
Absolutely.
We are doing this. Definitely. Are you up for it, Joe?
Absolutely. I'd love it. I'd love to do that. Love to do it.
Excellent.
It's also where he had...
We're doing it in that case.
Yeah, because it wasn't just Tolkien. I mean, C.S. Lewis, Charles Williams... Yeah, they're all there. They all used to go to that pub together. So
okay, well, that's a that is then a must. I also wanted to say in you know that my first son, I wanted the one who was just at Oxford, I wanted to name him on the shortlist was Strider, and instead my husband gave me a figurine of Aragorn when Lucas was born.
As a sort of, yeah, you know, you didn't get the name, but hey. Well, good, that's
fantastic.
Settled then. You're coming over. We're all going to Oxford. We're going to go have a pint.
Brilliant.
In the Eagle and Charle. And then I think, Joe, it's only fair, isn't it, that we get invited to Los Angeles and then we'll go and, you know, do the Raylan Chandler thing over there or something. Yeah,
definitely.
Okay,
I would say come to the Cape. Come to the Cape.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll come to the, whichever one we're invited
where
Tennis, to.
Where Tennessee Williams wrote many of his plays.
There we go. All right.
There we go.
We'll hold you to that later in the year. I love both of these pictures, and we've sort of been talking about both books for ages more because, and that's testament to them. I've got to pick one, haven't I? I think I'm going to pick Lucia Berlin, I think, because I think maybe she needs the recognition. Would you agree, Miranda?
No.
I tried to get you in on side there, but
no, of course. Joe and I as both debut novelists, first time novelists, right, Joe? We're both debut novelists, I think. We gotta give it up for the I know.
Yeah,
but you're totally wrong.
I loved both of those pictures. I would obviously choose Lord of the Rings in a heartbeat for many, many things. But based on those pictures, I had never, ever heard of Lucia Berlin, and we need to rectify that a little bit. And A Manual for Cleaning Women just sounds fab, Joe. So thank you for bringing it to
thank
our attention.
You.
And thank you for also, Miranda, making me think that it's time I read Lord of the Rings for a second time. I'll let you know
okay,
what I get
please
out of
do,
it.
Please do, yeah. I'll bring it to the pub and we'll never leave.
There you go, that's right. It. We'll have a lock-in.
Quarantine.
A Terrible Kindness by Joe Browning Rowe is out now and it's published by Faber and the Paper Palace by Miranda Cowley Heller is also out now and it's published by Viking. And what an absolute pleasure it's been to have both of you on the podcast. Thank you for joining us, thanks for your recommendations, and I look forward to our big trip to Oxford.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Joe, lovely to meet you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.